Dog Talk. I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of HCP Life. A recent update from the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report showed that 45% of observed COVID-19 patients for whom race or ethnicity data was available were white, compared to 55% of individuals in their surrounding community. But one-third of all hospitalized patients were black, versus just 18% in their communities. Another 8% of hospitalized patients were Hispanic, compared to 14% in the community. Minorities are overrepresenting the population of COVID-19 patients in hospitals right now. Death rates are also more severe for Black and Hispanic patients, almost doubled the rate of white or Asian patients to die from COVID-19 per 100,000 population. It doesn't take a pandemic to learn that health disparities are rampant among races and ethnicities in the U.S., but these particular findings are jarring as clinicians continue to seek out the means to reduce hospital burdens and disease severity in patients affected with the coronavirus. Of course, there's also public health-based value in tracking and interpreting the differing patients most burdened by the virus right now. Today, we share our interview with Dr. Panagis Galeostatos. Dr. Galeostatos holds a series of roles with Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, which greatly qualify him to discuss COVID-19 health disparities with us, including assistant professor in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine, scholar at the Center for Innovative Medicine, director of the Tobacco Treatment Clinic, co-chair of the Health Equity Steering Committee, and co-director of the Medicine for the Greater Good. Dr. Galeostatos helps set background for what's currently understood about the effect of the coronavirus in differing populations, before sharing a deeper history of health inequity in the U.S., and then sharing solutions for public health institutions to pursue. We hope you enjoy. Doc, so really just wanted to talk to you a little bit about, the differing populations and effects and burdens we're seeing. One of the biggest headlines I think I saw in the past week when we were discussing, some of the country sort of reopening is in certain locations, including Atlanta, the burden of the virus has been more severe in minority populations and as has the mortality rate. What exactly do you guys see on your end?
I think it's across the nation that we're seeing the most vulnerable populations being ravaged by COVID-19. And by vulnerable, minority populations and those specifically those of socioeconomically disadvantaged. In America, health disparities have always existed. This is not something new. We see it with almost every non-communicable disease, right? Your diabetes, your high blood pressure, your strokes, you see that, you see health disparities with that. And you also see it with contagious, communicable diseases, contagious infections, and so forth, from your HIV conversations to the disproportionate amount of cases of pneumonia. So we've always known of health disparities. COVID-19 has just expedited this conversation, right? When you see a title out of Richmond saying 100% of the mortalities are African Americans, I mean, for those of us who study health equity, it is not a shock, but it is an ethical reckoning. What to make of this is, for a lot of us, it's just welcome to the conversation. We've been having it for decades, and a pandemic will sure as heck shed light to these issues that we've been screaming about constantly. And the reason why this gets our attention now is because the deaths happen now. Deaths from non-communicable diseases get sometimes dragged on and so forth. But COVID-19 and the immediate and quick sense of passings and mortality, of course, is going to draw the attention, especially because it's being seen in a disproportionate, unfair, and yes, unethical sharing with by some populations more than others.
And of course, we see this sort of disparity already, obviously, in cardio metabolic disease, pulmonary disease, almost every major public health concern that we have. Related to crises, though, or epidemics, obviously a few scale in comparison to COVID-19 right now, but have we seen this similarly before in other outbreaks?
So I will actually take it to more of a common theme. So sepsis. Sepsis, right, is a syndrome where our own immune system has gone chaotic. When you get an infection, our immune system usually operates like a symphony. Well-tuned, harmonized. Yes, it may make someone uncomfortable, but it's killing the virus. In sepsis, your immune system becomes a cacophony. where, yeah, it is still likely probably killing off the virus, but it is causing severe organ dysfunction and failure everywhere else. I mean, you're in sepsis, it's a chaotic immune system in addition to an infection. The reason why I bring up sepsis is because it is a syndrome that's been known since ancient Greek times. I mean, the name sepsis comes from Hippocrates, meaning flesh rotting. And so the reason why I bring this up is sepsis disparity studies out of the U.S., right, dating back to 2003 from one of the largest epidemiological studies that ran through sepsis between 1979 and 2001, said, oh my gosh, African Americans suffer a disproportionate amount of both incidence of sepsis and clinical outcomes of it, meaning they had more sepsis from an incidence standpoint and had worse outcomes, meaning survival. And this finding has been reaffirmed countless times, where African Americans do worse than other populations, both in how many of them show up to the incidence to how many end up passing away. A study that I reviewed a few years back out of Jacksonville, a city where 30% of the population is African American, 50% African Americans accounted for the sepsis study. So we have known minorities suffer from infections on a larger scale. The reason why I highlight sepsis is because that is the, you know, that is the ultimate culmination of dysfunction of the immune system. And guess what puts people at risk for sepsis? If you have predisposition, right, pre-existing conditions, diabetes, right, high blood pressure. So when people discuss COVID-19's, you know, disparities, I point them to sepsis, mm-hmm, right? Here's a syndrome that, if you have horrible pre-existing conditions and it's been linked with socioeconomic disadvantages, yeah, you have worse outcomes. And COVID-19 being an infection causes sepsis. So I don't think we need to look elsewhere other than the most common manifestation that leads someone in the intensive care unit, sepsis. So yeah, I can easily say, you know, what we're seeing with COVID-19 aligns with everything we've known about this syndrome for the last several decades here in the U.S.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean,
hopefully that was well put. I apologize for answering your question kind of not tangentially, but really highlighting one of the key concerns we have out of the ICU.
No. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's completely applicable. And I think it, you know, raises the point that, you know, again, this is not our first rodeo with this. This shouldn't come as a surprise, unfortunately, you know, to our experts and researchers looking at this right now. And I think another part of it that's going to have to be, you know, dictated when we're considering the burden that we're going to see in these populations with COVID's development is also now in treatments. You know, there was a big back and forth, obviously, with remdesivir recently in the past week or so over trial results that are only over a few dozen. And obviously, we can't be choosing beggars right now in terms of you know, how many patients are in it. Obviously, we're very limited until, you know, greater and greater assessments come out. But you do hope, obviously, when we're considering treatment, this patient population, because that's still a continued issue in many of these fields like we were talking about.
No, 100%. I mean, we see disparities in almost every facet of medicine, both from clinical and as well as research. I mean, the other population that probably won't get as emphasized in the research trials are your Spanish-speaking patients, those that don't speak English as a first language. You know, as a person who sits on the ethical board reviews, I countless times see trials being submitted, and they intend to exclude patients who don't speak English. And a lot of this, honestly, it's more from a feasibility standpoint because no one has the services to that with a Spanish-speaking person who's certified in it. However, now in this pandemic, we are seeing Hispanic Latino populations being ravaged by it. You know, this is a minority population that oftentimes has a disadvantagement from a socioeconomic status. And so they're at prey to COVID-19's disparities, just like other minority populations. And I say this because I'm imagining the what we've established as pre-pandemic, right, where we saw research disparities, is going to continue. And my colleagues and I, Johns Hopkins, constantly discuss this. Like, how can we make our institutional review board, right, the IRB that reviews studies based on merits and ethics, how can we assure that the Hispanic Latino population is not excluded from these studies, right? Yeah. And the reason why to emphasize this, though, is because you need to see how clinical outcomes manifest in a diverse population. Only then can you sit back with an equitable lens and say, clearly we need to allocate more resources there. If not everyone is starting from the same start line, and so that's why you're going to see so many disadvantagements in regards to outcomes, even if someone can say, well, I gave them equal care. Fair, but not everyone started at the same beginning line. So yeah, that's my concern about the research is also going to be one that skews towards non-minority populations and potentially more affluent populations as well.
Do you think that this consideration should also be carried over maybe even into, let's say, vaccination research as we begin clinical trials? I know there's a stress on assuring that certain doses or variants are safe for, say, a young healthy adult population before advancing it to a greater at-risk patient populations. Inherently, you know, minorities that already carry comorbidity risk would already be as part of that at-risk population that would be tested for safety prior before starting it. But do you think, I guess, demographically speaking, they should already be in that secondary group?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that every treatment should be evaluated by almost every diverse population. I completely understand that the concepts of race and ethnicity are social constructs, but they are good surrogates to kind of have an understanding of extrinsic factors that impact populations, right? We know, you can take minority populations and put them in more affluent areas and they do better. And a lot of it speaks to these non-biological factors that drive certain outcomes. So the reason why I say all this is because, yes, a vaccine shouldn't just be given to one homogenous population. It should be given to as many diverse populations as possible so we can assess its efficacy and stand firm and say, hey, if medicine is a public trust, this intervention should work just as well for our Spanish-speaking individual with an median income of $10,000, just as much as it would for our white individual with a median income of $120,000. And the way you can say that firmly is because you've evaluated in both of those populations, as opposed to extrapolating and think it should work for him and her if it worked for him and her.
All right, Doc, if we could talk maybe solutions right now, or at least prospects towards solutions, I think that'd be great. Is there anything that comes
up? No, happy to.
Mind? Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, listen, this pandemic will end, health disparities will not. My biggest frustration is a lot of what we're seeing now, most people's responses are transient actions of, oh, all right, let's have a cultural sensitive fill in the blank. My first request is a firm commitment, meaning we are not going to address health disparities when it suits us, when the timing feels right. It is going to be a staple of medicine now and moving forward. It needs to be. I mean, meaning at the end of the day, every intervention that we do, the ethics should be tied in with its equity, right? Are we assuring the proper allocation of a variety of resources for every diverse population? So honestly, the first part is just as simple as a commitment and a one that's tied into action and consistency. I see this because, you know, I've seen this, you know, Freddie Gray riots in Baltimore City in 2015. We heard a lot of people, I mean, because those riots ravaged more disadvantaged populations. And we heard a lot of people like step up. And my friend, 5 years later, we're back to square one, right? Those same populations are being ravaged now by the pandemic, just as they were ravaged by the riots. So I'm not asking for action, right? Most actions are transient in their timing. I'm asking for a firm commitment. So action step number one is a commitment by every medical institution and hospital to say health equity will be added to our mission. Yeah. Number two is get all other key players involved that help create the health inequities. Now, I know this is a big ask, but what I mean by this, as a physician, as a doctor, I'm accountable 100% for health outcomes of my patients. My frustration with that is that I have no control over the non-biological factors that will end up creating the inequities that we talk about, right? Schools, right? If they are, you know, disproportionate in regards to how the education is discussed from one population to another, you'll create ultimate health inequities. Transportation, if one community has easier access to get around than another one, you'll create inequities. Food access, if one population has access to very nutritional, cost-effective food, they're going to do much better than another population that doesn't have those same access, right? So I would say action step number two, we need to revamp how people are held accountable for health inequities. It cannot fall to a hospital. Your hospital is your last line of dealing with inequities.
Yeah.
If every other facet of society felt accountable, I mean, could you imagine if a housing unit felt accountable for providing equitable housing, right? If you know, that would be so ideal. And therefore, then your disparity gaps wouldn't be there, right? You wouldn't see disproportionate numbers dying from this virus. So action step number two is have non-traditional healthcare players become involved in healthcare. I know that's a tall ask. I apologize, but it's my plea. I mean, there's not a doctor or a hospital or a healthcare system that will fix this. And it's going to require everyone else feeling accountable for this.
I think it's funny you say that, Doc, because something I was thinking of as we were talking about this is, you know, a couple of years ago, I attended a talk where a physician explained how the issue of pollution and its effect on a person's health and mortality is actually a very demographic-based issue, and it's very cyclical in nature. These people are already more likely to be living in food deserts. They're more likely to have low-income jobs, therefore have less access to healthcare, have worse coverage, have to work in jobs that are exposing them to pollutants, and so on and so forth. Essentially, every part of their life and you know their day feeds into the health issue that they're having, and vice versa. So, I was going to ask if there's any other part outside of healthcare that you imagine would, if we could alter feasibly, tangibly, to improve, you know, this disparity. Where do you think that is?
I mean, from my standpoint, if I had to put most of my stock in one area to be able to see some mitigation of disparities, I know I'm a physician. I know I should talk about medicine, but remember, to me, medicine and health are not synonymous. Health is much more complex. It's more holistic. In medicine, we really strike this conversation of prevention and reaction to pathologies. But the challenge is the things that we're asked to prevent, a lot of, like, I can't prevent diabetes by constantly just checking your A1C. If you live in an environment with high stress and anxiety, that pumps up you up full of cortisol, that raises your blood glucose levels, periodically, little bit by little, then you add some processed food because that's the only access you have. And then, you know, it's a cascade I have no control over. So the first thing that I would probably put an emphasis on is education. I know that's a long-term goal, but education tends to be both protective and preventative that mitigates disparities. And we see that here in Baltimore City. The more formal education our populations have, regardless of minority and race status and creed, the better their health outcomes are at the end of the day. So if we really want to make an emphasis, you know, if you ask me one thing, I will put it on education highly. In the immediate sense, I mean, honestly, it falls back to every hospital not only just making a health equity commitment, but one that makes also a commitment. Actually, I apologize. There is something more tangible to do. One that makes a commitment from every hospital to emphasize community engagement. I should have gone with that first. I apologize. So what do I mean by community engagement is every hospital is highly interested for the most part in what's called population health, right? To them to try to figure out how to care for patients in the most cost-effective way. Here at Hopkins, I mean, we've been able to create really novel population health strategies through community engagement. I mean, you may say, well, that sounds obvious. I mean, let me give you an example. The church that had the fire during the riots in 2015, Southern Baptist, we partnered with them moving forward. Strong commitment. And I will never forget one of the conversations that really showcases the difference between health and medicine was when we tried to discuss vaccinations, flu shots. And, you know, the reverend was like, my congregation's interested in working. They need to work. You know, if they miss a day of work, they don't get paid. It's a day-to-day job. So what my staff did was go and present them data that, hey, flu shots keep kids from missing days of school. So if kids don't miss school, parents can go to work. That's an income. Also, there's evidence to showcase that getting the flu shot means less days of adults missing work. Adults don't miss a day of work, you get paid. So there's a medical intervention rooted in science and evidence-based tied into a community's interest. And it came to fruition. We vaccinated well over 300 people over several weekends. And we continue to do that. So I say that because if you want to at least make an immediate impact, you know, I just emphasize education. I emphasize people need to make a health equity its mission. And you're like, all right, that's still not a tangible action. What else is? Emphasize community engagement. Make people trained into community engagement, into cultural sensitivity, so they understand the communities that they are serving. That needs to be a priority. You know, people get trained to be, for instance, statisticians. Great. People should also be trained to be community engagers. What does that mean? How do you approach a community in a grassroots approach? How do you identify the community's health interests, what health means to them? And how do you align a public health initiative rooted in a population health strategy that aligns with the community's interests? Because the more it does with that, the more impact you will have. People will follow through with population health strategies if it is rooted in a community health interest, jobs, access to food, a sense of being, and so forth. So I apologize. This should have come to me first, but my plea in the immediate sense is every hospital to put as much stock into their community engagement arm as possible. And by the way, this is also kind of stealing a quote out of Dr. Fauci in a Washington Post interview when he said, what did you learn from the AIDS epidemic that you're applying now? He said it's community engagement. He's like, authorities requesting certain public health actions can only be done effectively if they engage with a community who has the anxiety and stress over how to do that. We're seeing the same thing with COVID-19. So if you have a strong investment in community engagement offices, the second a pandemic hits, you pull on those strings of trust, everyone gets together and acts on it. And by the way, I'm not sure how much insight you know of me, but that's what we've done in our own divisions with our community engagement arms. We have now, since March 16th, been holding twice a week phone calls where we discuss community resources as well as up-to-date COVID-19 facts from a trusted resource. And it's attended by well over 100 community leaders who have a reach of their own to thousands of Baltimore City citizens. So that would be a nice key step. So I apologize for kind of a roundabout way of getting to that eureka moment. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. Thank you for touching on that. I mean, it still ties in very well, right? So, absolutely. That was a pretty great summarization, I think, of pretty feasible, tangible steps that almost any healthcare network, like you said, can take in the short term to, you know, resolve this. So is there anything else you want to add, Doc?
No, that's it. I think you covered everything on my end.
Yeah, I'd say so too. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. You know, you mentioned us being busy at the top, but you guys, everything that you're doing right now is so commendable, from outreach to care to research to dissemination, education, discussion. It's been remarkable on your team's end. So thank you so much for everything you're doing, Doc, and thanks for your time right now.
You got it, my friend. Well, be well and let me know how more I can help.
Take Absolutely. Care.
For these stories and more, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com. For Doc Talk, I'm Kevin Consman. Thank you for listening.